Hi, this is Matt Kundle. This is number 0464, The Stuff File, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0464. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actress Patrika Darbo. She's a character actor with a varied and long career. Everybody knows her face from the myriad of roles she's had.
It's so funny. It's like when I look at people's ages, I can kind of say, you grew up with me on Step by Step and Growing Pains and Just the Ten of Us. You grew up with me on In the Line of Fire, or that's the movies that you like with Clint Eastwood, and you know me from the soap operas. So it's kind of looking at ages and stuff like that and different people's. I can kind of tell how they know me.
One of my favorite fiction writers, Dennis Palumbo, is back. His fifth Daniel Rinaldi mystery, Head Wounds, is now out in an audio version.
My Daniel Rinaldi novels are written in the first person, so the narrator is Daniel. And so when I listen to the actor read it, it's really amazing because this is the character of Daniel Rinaldi. And it is very different because as a screenwriter, all you ever hear is the actor saying your words. In a novel, this actor also describes people's expressions and the environment. So it's really that experience of sitting down and having someone tell you a story.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter invades the fairways of Bushwood Country Club. Tell the wild, unpredictable story of Caddyshack. So to quote the Dalai Lama via Carl Spackler, Goonga Galunga, which means the Cinderella story is coming up later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0464, was broadcaster, podcaster, radio consultant, voice specialist, and an all-around nice guy, Matt Kundle. His company is Sound Off Media, and you can check out his two podcasts. One is the Sound Off Podcast, and the other is Hot Air Podcast. And you'll find the link to both of those shows on the Stuff File program, which he just mentioned the number for. See the synergy, how this all goes around in a circle? Yeah, works out fine. Thank you very much, Matt, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Daniel Maida was driving on Interstate 85 in Miami, Florida, when he noticed a man on the hood of the car next to him. All I was thinking, Maida said, was this guy is going to slide off and hit me, slide off the other side, or if anything, he's going to slide down and she's going to hit him, and then she's going to crash into somebody else. There was a woman driving the car at speeds of up to 70 miles per hour, and the man on the hood was talking on the phone to the police. 24-year-old Patricia Isidore and 22-year-old Junior Francis both share ownership of the car. Now, according to Francis, both of them needed the car, but Isidore beat him to it, so Francis jumped on the hood to keep her from leaving. It didn't work. She drove off anyway. That's when things took a turn, Francis said. She turned onto the interstate, and Francis held on until Isidore exited, and he was able to get the keys out of the ignition. Isidore was arrested and charged with crimes against a person exposing them to harm, but Francis told police he didn't want to press charges and refused to provide a sworn statement. "This woman is going to kill me," he said to reporters later. "She's really out to kill me." And yet he won't make an official statement to police. Go figure. They should really go to couples therapy, but I'm guessing they can't decide on who should drive there. You know, so many weird stories on this show seem to come out of Florida. This one could simply be called carpooling Florida style. Another case of Florida weird, how much alcohol do you have to drink to imagine your chauffeur has four paws? Apparently, three times the legal limit in Florida, or a bunch of drinks, as 56-year-old Scott Garrett of Port St. Lucie told troopers after he was pulled over for erratic driving. According to the arrest report, Garrett was snagged by Florida Highway Patrol officers on May 16th because he drove past a trooper while going southbound on I-95 in Martin County outside Port St. Lucie. Garrett was drifting and traveling under the speed limit when officers pulled him over. They then smelled the telltale aroma of alcohol, a bottle of Sailor Jerry spiced rum, 92 proof, on the Nissan's passenger side, did Garrett no favors. Garrett stood at the rear of his car using the trunk to maintain his balance while he was being questioned. Garrett allegedly told the officer he had quarreled with his girlfriend and then asked the officer for a ride home. According to the trooper, Garrett then said he wasn't driving the Nissan, but rather his dog was doing the driving. There is no indication of whether there was a dog in the car with Garrett. Yeah. Field sobriety tests reported Garrett had a blood alcohol content of 0.252 and 0.248, which is more than three times the legal limit of 0.08 in Florida. Boy, you have to be really drunk to think that a dog that isn't with you is driving your car. I guess it finished eating your homework. That story wouldn't be believable even in a 1960s sitcom. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police say orange-colored ecstasy pills bearing an image resembling President Donald Trump's face are making the rounds in northern Indiana, which ironically is Vice President Mike Pence's state. Indiana State Police said in a statement that a face is stamped on the front of the illegal pills and the rear bears the words "Great Again" in apparent reference to Trump's Make America Great Again campaign pledge. Police say 129 arrests were made during a six-day traffic stop operation in June. LSD, cocaine, and other drugs were also seized. Traffickers sometimes produce uniquely shaped or colored illegal drugs as a marketing technique to distinguish their wares from the competition and encourage buyers to return for more. You know, I've seen pictures of the drugs. I don't know if Trump would be flattered. They kind of look like Flintstone vitamins. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Patrika Darbo is a very busy actress. You may not know her name, but you have certainly seen or heard her in a myriad of projects. She's the winner of the 2016 inaugural Primetime Emmy for Best Actress Short Format for the internet comedy series Acting Dead. She's a veteran of over 30 years in film and television in such films as Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, Speed 2, Babe, and In the Line of Fire, just to name a few. On TV, she's had regular roles on The Bold and the Beautiful, Days of Our Lives, and Step by Step, and she's guested on everything from The Middle to The Big Bang Theory to Desperate Housewives to Seinfeld. Patrika joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Patrika.
Hello.
I spent so much time talking about the things you've done, I think we're out of time now.
Yeah, honey, I'm an old doll and I've been around the block a few times.
There's so much that you've done. There's so much we can talk about. So I just want to go back to the beginning, and that is, when you first decided to embark on a career in acting, did you envision what your career has become and how diverse it is?
No, I don't think so. And I think I also, as I said, kind of jokingly that I'm an old doll, I also grew up in the time where your parents said, oh my God, you got to learn how to type. You got to know how to type. You got to have a job. So, and acting was, you know, something you did part-time and you played with, but it wasn't a profession, or you just weren't going to be a star, or you weren't going to make a living at it. So, I held down a full-time job as a lady executive before I even embarked full-time on acting. So I've been very blessed with two careers, and to have my dream career of being an actor Don't ever let anybody tell you you can't have your dreams, because you can. You just have to work extra hard sometimes.
Now, that's interesting, because you say you were an executive, so I would assume being an executive, there is a certain amount of stability and grounding in that. It's even more difficult for some people to make that leap into something that is unknown, like acting, when you have something that you're giving up.
Yes, and again, because I grew up in a time where you need to know how to type, and, you know, this is only a plaything, acting, so you need to have stability in your life, and you always want that security. So it was a little hard, but I think in this time of Me Too, I can say that I had a gentleman say to me that I was a woman no more than a goat, and to never contradict him again.
Wow.
At which point I went into the president and told him they had 20 minutes or 2 weeks because I would not work with that person, and they were very lucky that I didn't sue them. So, but in hindsight, it was kind of a blessing, because I suddenly started looking at my career saying, part-time, I've been making as much as I have full-time at the other job. So I just embarked on my career full-time.
Now, you just described an incident where you obviously had the foresight to stand up for yourself, and probably at a time when a lot of people didn't have that, shall we say, Norma Rae moment. What is it about your personality that allowed you to do what you did?
You know what? To be real honest, I don't know how to answer that question. I just know at that point, this person demeaned me so much that I didn't have an alternative. I think it was kind of like I suddenly was in a corner going, wait a second, I'm worth more than this. And I was only trying to help him, not to undermine anything he was doing. And which I didn't say before, he had just started with the company. I'd been with the company over a year, so I was trying to let him know that he'd gotten some incorrect information, but not in a demeaning way, because it was, anyway, that's neither here nor there. I don't exactly know what suddenly made me say, no, this is not going to happen. So, jokingly, I can say when I did stand up briefly, I just went, it was the best moment of my life, and I went bye to him, and that was it. So.
Now, I'm guessing for a lot of people, and I listed a whole bunch of credits, I'm guessing one of the things people recognize you for the most would be The Bold and the Beautiful. Would that be correct?
Well, I'm not sure. I was on Days of Our Lives for almost 10 years, so that's probably
true.
Longer, because I only did Bold for a year. But I think it's so funny. It's like when I look at people's ages, I can kind of say, you grew up with me on Step by Step and Growing Pains and Just the 10 of Us. You grew up with me on In the Line of Fire. Or that's the movies that you like with Clint Eastwood. And you know me from the soap operas. So it's kind of looking at ages and stuff like that and different people's. I can kind of tell how they know me. And then other people will go, oh, my God, you were the lady on Seinfeld, like this. I mean, it's so interesting. I'm just one of those character places. I get accosted accosted is probably the wrong word. I get approached in grocery stores a lot of times with people going, are you going to bake cookies or cupcakes? And I'm like, for what? Well, isn't that what the teacher said? Well, the kids should bring cookies or cupcakes. And I'll be like, oh, hon, I think you've got me mistaken with somebody else. And then they'll look at me, and then they, like, go, oh, my God, you're on my soap opera. So it's kind of things that happen like that a lot. So it's very interesting.
With all the things you've done in your career, is there, and again, varied, is there something you're dying to do, something you've always wanted to do, that opportunity hasn't come your way yet?
I would love to do Broadway. I've never done Broadway. I've done theater here in Los Angeles. In fact, my husband and I met in Little Theater and got married on stage. So I've always loved that. One of my favorite roles here was in Del Shore's Daddy's Dying, Who's Got the Will. I did the play for 2 years. We went to Edinburgh and performed it, and then I got to reprise my role in the film. So doing Broadway would be on my bucket list.
And do you prefer drama or comedy?
You know what? I think that's hard to say, too. I mean, comedy comes natural to me. One of the best things that ever happened to me was a drama teacher wouldn't let me do comedy for a year in class one time because he said, that comes too easy. You need to work on the drama side. You need so because you rely too heavily on it. And I think that comes from being a heavy kid all my life, you know, being called fatso and that kind of bullying going on. I learned to make people laugh with me instead of at me. So comedy sort of came natural. And the and comedy has really got a dark side sometimes. So working on the drama side, I love doing it all, but sometimes just to let people know that I can do that is a good thing.
Now, I said in the introduction that you won the 2016 inaugural Primetime Emmy for Best Actress in a Short Format for the internet comedy series Acting Dead. Internet is something, of course, that is branching out and taking a lot of the entertainment thunder away from what we generally know as television, and it's getting a lot of attention. But it's a new frontier, so new that recently you had an Emmy taken away from you. Not that one, but
yeah,
another one.
This past year for the Daytime Emmys, I was nominated for Best Supporting Actress in The Bay, which is, I think it's in its fourth. I get too confused as to what's going on, because anyway, it's been around for a while, and what the producers didn't realize was that you can only be a guest once. I mean, you can continually appear in the show, but you could only be in the first season. If you're a guest in the first season, you can't be nominated against. Well, I had been in the season before, so I was in the wrong category. And unfortunately, it wasn't vetted properly, so NATIS, the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, missed it. And unfortunately, they missed another person in the category, and then they missed another person in the category. And in this kind of a situation, when these are some of the highest honors in television, I think that NATIS made some mistakes that should be rectified and that there should have been some kind of audit going on. If there were that many mistakes in one category, what was going on in some of the other categories? I think Jennifer Bassey, who was known as Mrs. Colby on All My Children, she was supposed to have gotten my Emmy, and then they found she had an error, and she's disputing right this moment, well, if I had an error, my error is the same error that the young man who won for supporting actor had, so why is he getting to keep his Emmy and I'm losing my Emmy? So there's so much going on there that's wrong, and I think there are three other producers who are asking for an audit to be done. At this point, I really don't know what's happening there. As the governor of the Television Academy in Los Angeles, which is just the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, I am the performer's governor. My concern and what I really feel bad for is with that many errors going on, how many actors lost their opportunity to be nominated and ultimately win. And having won my Emmy in 2016, it is the most exhilarating, fabulous thing to happen to you. And to know that it comes from your peers is so wonderful. And even though I was in the wrong category, my peers voted for my performance and said, you're the best. So those kind of accolations, I think that I just said that word wrong, but those kind of accolades are so heartwarming and so humbling that I feel so bad for the actors that lost the opportunity to have that happen. And that ultimately still comes back to NATIS. They need to figure out where they went wrong and what's going on and if other stuff slipped through the loopholes, because they are taking away from people who deserve it.
And we should point out, because, you know, you see these headlines splashed on websites all over the place that this has happened and that has happened. We should point out that producers submit videotape for the categories that are up for awards. It's not something the individual actor does. It's not something that you choose which scenes are used. It's something that's done totally out of your control, correct?
You know, absolutely, and that's why there's supposed to be a very strong vetting system going on, so that you make sure that these kind of things don't happen. And I don't want any kind of a dark cloud hanging over the Emmy, because I cherish mine, as I'm sure everybody else that's won theirs cherishes theirs. So to have something say, you know, there's this many mistakes, and it just needs to be examined thoroughly. And again, I have to go back to the fact that since I was not supposed to be there, there's an actor who lost his chance. since Tom Calabro was not supposed to be there, there's another actor that lost their chance to fill our two spots. Since they said Jennifer wasn't supposed to be there, there's another actor. And then the two people that were left, they eliminated the whole category, so they lost out. So there's two actors that lost out. And they said, well, we'll let you submit for free next year. Well, but they can't resubmit because then they'd be in the same boat that I was in. Hmm. That they're submitting for a second season, and you can only be in one season. So everybody lost in this point in the actor part of it, but not in the Natas didn't get reprimanded. The producers are not getting reprimanded. The actor lost, and that to me is, as a governor of the Academy here, is just unconscionable because we work too hard. We work too hard for what we want, and our fellow actors say these people deserve it, and then this kind of thing happens. So we need a better vetting system.
Well, I hope it will work itself out in some way, shape, or form, certainly before the next year rolls around, and even before that, so that they can clear up what happened this year. But in the meantime, for those who are fans of yours, and again, you do so much, where can we see you coming, and what do you have upcoming that you can share?
Well, The Ladies of the Lake, just which is another digital series, just released their next season. I've been invited back to the Bay, which is where a lot of this happened, so I'm doing that. I've got three other opportunities coming up in the digital series because that's where it's all about now, that is in our digital thing for all these new series and stuff going on. And it's not just young filmmakers that are doing it. You look at the Amazons and the Hulus, and all these people are producing their own digital series. The short form for the Academy here in Los Angeles, the Primetime Emmys, that was a very small little bit of people that entered in that first short form year. This time there's like up to 1,000 or more that are submitting. So it's growing exponentially each and every year. And there's so many opportunities for young filmmakers and young actors to get going, and which again comes back to everybody's got to be tight on how they vet things and the rules that go with it.
Patrika, it's a pleasure and an honor to have the opportunity to talk to you. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I mean, without fans and without people that get to know about you, we sort of grow stagnant. So this is an opportunity for me to say hello to all my Canadian friends up there. I just finished filming in Victoria, too, which was great. So there'll be another Christmas movie coming out that everybody will get to see that was filmed in Victoria. So I'm very blessed. Thank you.
Actress Patrika Darbo. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0464, and you'll find links to her website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to Dennis Palumbo, author of Head Wounds. We have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nolman, so stick around for that. There's also an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. And we have much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, animal researchers in Britain say they have noticed an uptick in calls to rescue drunk seagulls that apparently get into brewery waste. RSPCA officers Joe Daniel, Clara Scully, and Paul Adams said that they have responded to more than a dozen calls in recent weeks about gulls exhibiting the same intoxication symptoms. The animal rescue charity said the birds are believed to have gotten into waste from a brewery or alcohol provider. At first, the birds look like they have botulism, but then, after vomiting, they seem to recover, Daniel said. The birds absolutely stink of alcohol when we collect them, so now our vans smell like pubs. RSPCA veterinarian David Cooper said most of the intoxicated gulls were collected in Devon, but some were spotted in Dorset. The birds appear disoriented and confused and struggle to stand. We took some video of one of the birds who is staggering around and losing his balance, just like a person would do if they had too much to drink, the veterinarian said. The RSPCA is urging breweries and other alcohol producers to make sure their waste isn't being left where wild animals can get to it. Clara Scully is a hoot with her quotes. These birds were clearly wearing their beer goggles. Got it? Goggles. When they scavenge their meal for the day, and they've really been suffering with hangovers after a gull's night out. Oh, that knee slapper Scully is. Anyway, this kind of reminds me of my teenage years. I used to work in movie theaters as a kid, so I would be driving home late at night. Now, I lived in a neighborhood that had a lot of Italian families, and they tended to make their own wine. Neighborhood cats would get into some of the alcohol waste, and as I was driving home, my headlights would reflect off the eyes of sometimes a dozen or more cats that were in the middle of the street, wasted, unable to move. You would have to try to navigate around them while they were just staring at the car in a glazed look. It was one of the creepiest occurrences of my youth because when you parked your car, you didn't know if the cats were just going to stand there staring at you or attack as you tried to walk to your front door. Drunk cats. Now, that's a horror movie somewhere. Yeah. Anyway. It's about a week since the U.S. celebrated their Independence Day, so the drunk firework stories are starting to come out now. Our first one comes from Lakeland, Florida, where a video was recorded on the night of July 4th of a man who thought alcohol would make him immune to explosions as well as regret. He was wrong on both counts. 35-year-old Jonathan Soto of Lakeland suffered injuries on his left hand and his chest after he grabbed a mortar-style firework and waited for it to explode. The firework blew up in his hand, and EMS was called to the scene at approximately 10:40 p.m. Alcohol appears to be a factor in the incident, as a surveillance camera that captured the moment the firework exploded in Soto's hand seemed to show him holding a beer in the other hand. His now good hand, I guess you could say. Another incident was a bit more dramatic. An Ohio man seemed to have blown his car up while he was inside of it when he failed to throw a lit firework out of the window. Keyshawn Rivers was severely burned when the fireworks exploded inside his car. Dayton police detectives continue to investigate the incident, saying they are awaiting the results of a lab analysis for confirmation that the explosion was caused by fireworks. It's also too early in the investigation to determine what Rivers was doing in the car just before the explosion occurred, or if he was impaired in any way. But detectives are still evaluating evidence and statements related to the case, and they are considering criminal charges. You know, it's only because we can't confirm the inebriation part of this story that we didn't make the second guy the idiot of the day. But he will have an interesting story to tell his insurance adjuster for his car. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we weren't the only parts of the world having a heat wave and very dry weather over the last couple of weeks. Police say a burning bird falling from an overhead electrical line set fire to a field in northern Germany that was parched by dry weather, torching some 7 hectares or 17 acres of land. Police in the Baltic seaport city of Rostock said witnesses reported that the bird caused a short circuit in a railway power line and fell to the ground in flames. The neighboring field then caught fire, and more than 50 firefighters were deployed to tackle the blaze on Tuesday evening. Farmers in northeastern Germany have been complaining of the effects of a persistent lack of rain over the past 2 months. You know, it's stories like these that proves there is a God, and that he also has a Rube Goldberg sense of humor. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in January, we spoke to one of my favorite writers, Dennis Palumbo. He's the author of the Daniel Rinaldi series of crime novels. We spoke when his fifth book in the series came out, called Head Wounds. Well, now the audio version of the latest Rinaldi mystery is out. In the books, Daniel Rinaldi is a therapist who works with the police. In real life, Dennis Palumbo is also a licensed psychotherapist and a former Hollywood screenwriter. Before we talk to Dennis, here's a clip from the audiobook. It features Rinaldi reading over old police records, recounting the murder of his wife several years before.
It was the material pertaining to Barbara's death that drew my repeated, almost obsessive interest. Personal details were compiled by the police at the start of their investigation. Her own family's history, her noted career as a linguistics professor at Pitt, her marriage to me not long after we'd first met as graduate students. Then came the forensics from the crime scene, the futile canvas of the surrounding area, leads that went nowhere, anonymous tips that never panned out, and finally their interview with me a month after the mugging, as I lay in the hospital bed recovering from my own gunshot wound. There hadn't been much I could tell them. Barbara and I had been approached coming out of a restaurant at the Point by an armed thug in a hoodie. He was about my size, I vaguely recalled, though his face was almost totally obscured by the peaked hood and the black of night. A chilled darkness, barely broken by the restaurant's soft-hued exterior lamps and a single light canopied over the valet parking kiosk. It had all happened in what seemed like moments. The guy grabbed for Barbara's purse. She resisted, and I tried to intervene. In the struggle, three shots went off, two finding my wife. I took the third to my head, putting me on the ground. Then the mugger ran off, his echoing footsteps the last thing I remembered before passing out. He was never found.
Dennis joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program again. As you know, and as I said in the intro, I love your work. I read Head Wounds when it first came out. Now it's out in an audio version. First of all, have your previous four Rinaldi books been in audio version? And did the same actor read all four? Or all five?
Yeah. All five of the books now they've all been in audiobook version. The first two was read by a different actor, the last three by an actor named Tom Taylorson. I think he does a great job. My books are in hardcover, paperback, e-reader, audiobook, and for a special price, I come over to your place and read them aloud. You know, it's just, if we can agree on a price.
Now, you have written scripts before. As I said, you're a former Hollywood screenwriter, so you're used to the idea of someone speaking your words. But is it any different in the novel form when you write something that later on becomes vocalized by somebody else in an audiobook?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially because my Daniel Rinaldi novels are written in the first person. So the narrator is Daniel. And so when I listen to the narrator read it, the actor read it, it's really amazing because this is the character of Daniel Rinaldi. And it is very different because as a screenwriter, all you ever hear is the actor saying your words. In a novel, this actor also describes people's expressions and the environment and descriptions of the city of Pittsburgh in which the story takes place. So it's really that experience of sitting down and having someone tell you a story. And I just have always, since I was a kid, loved people telling me stories. So if you're into audiobooks, what you get is Daniel Rinaldi telling you the story of what happened to him. And I think it's quite powerful.
Since this same actor has read the last three books, so 3, 4, and 5, when you were writing 4 and 5, did his voice seep into your head and your psyche while you were in the writing process?
Actually not. Unsurprisingly, it's my voice that sneaks into the writing process. Daniel Rinaldi is a sort of glorified version of me, And so when I'm writing it, literally as I'm typing, I hear my own voice say the words. Often I read them aloud. After I write a paragraph or two, I'll read over aloud what I just wrote. And so it's my voice. And so, like, I'm listening to the Head Wounds audio now, and it always takes a chapter or two before Taylorson's voice now becomes the voice of Daniel Rinaldi. He does a great job. But it takes a couple chapters of the audiobook before I realize, oh, that's what Daniel sounds like to anyone else listening to this story.
Now, I don't want to give any of the story away because I hate when that happens. I don't like spoilers and whatnot. But as we played in the clip, you've learned that Daniel's wife was murdered several years before. We knew of this in reading the previous books, but her murder is now in the forefront of this particular story, and I don't want to go any further than that, other than let people read it to find out. But you yourself as the writer, are you, as you go along, and I hope there's more Danny Rinaldi stories in the future, are you learning more about the character that you created as you continue to write?
Absolutely. In fact, in the first four books, we only know that Daniel Rinaldi and his wife were mugged 12 years before. And during the mugging, it went sideways. Gunshots were fired. She was killed. He was wounded. And when he recovered, he had so much survivor guilt that that was the impetus for his mission to treat victims of violent crime, people struggling with symptoms of PTSD or survivor guilt. And I've learned a lot about Daniel and his symptoms in the four books I've written. But it wasn't until I got to this one that I realized the backstory of the mugging wasn't enough. I wanted to know exactly what that mugging was about. And so the reader learns right away that this dossier that Daniel is reading that is about the police investigation of the mugging, somewhere in that dossier is a clue, he's been told, that it wasn't just a regular mugging. His wife was deliberately murdered, and that sets the stage as he discovers who the killer is, for a cat-and-mouse game between Daniel and this killer from many years ago. And it's also a first for me in that even though my Rinaldi novels are thrillers, they're also mysteries. And so we don't know who the bad guy or the killer is to the end. In this book, I do something different. I tell the readers by page 50 who the bad guy is so that you can then just have this cat-and-mouse a very deadly one, between Daniel Rinaldi and the killer. And it was very interesting to write it in that way.
You mentioned dealing with things like PTSD and the troubles that Daniel himself has personally had. One is very protective of the characters they write, especially now that there's a little bit of closure, and I won't say what that is, but there's a little bit of closure with his past in this particular book. Do you feel the need or the urge to want to help Daniel to heal more? Or do you feel that's one of the things that makes him endearing to the reader as a character in general, to let him be a little bit on the darker side?
Well, he'll always be on the darker side because his sensibility is mine. But reality is yeah, there is a sense of this chapter in his life. There's enough of a closure that he can now move on. You know, he's never been in a solid long-term relationship with anyone since this. I mean, he's had some flings and encounters, but and this now might give him the opportunity, and I've been thinking about this, to actually pursue another relationship. And he'll still have the concerns he has for his patients, and he'll still have flashbacks to the incident where his wife was killed. But there's no question that some healing happens at the end of this book. And I think poor Daniel had it. He was long overdue for some healing, so I thought I'd give him some.
Well, again, it's another great book. The book is called Head Wounds, which is now out in an audio version. It's not necessary to go back and read the previous four to get into Head Wounds, although I really do urge you go back and read the previous four, which are Mirror Image, Fever Dream, Night Terrors, and Phantom Limb. They're all great. Dennis, I've got to ask, I know I've asked in the past, if there's a possibility that this could ever come to film or to television. I mean, you now have a situation where you have an actor who regularly plays him in the book version, the audiobook version. Have you ever envisioned who could play Daniel on the big or small screen?
Well, actually, we are pursuing. My literary manager and I are pursuing doing the series of books as a television series. We have some producers interested. You know, in Hollywood, that and $5 get you a cup of latte. But we do have some interest. And there's any number of actors who could play Daniel Rinaldi. In my head, it's gone everywhere from Chris Maloney from Law & Order SVU to Anthony LaPaglia. I just think there's any number of wonderful actors who could play Daniel Rinaldi on TV. So keep your fingers crossed. We're gonna try to make that happen.
And in the meantime, the latest book is Head Wounds. And those two actors you mentioned, by the way, both excellent choices. Dennis, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Peter. And I want your listeners to know that they can always check out my website to learn about the books, to read the reviews and the blurbs. It's DennisPalumbo.com, very cleverly named website. And I hope people check it out.
Dennis Palumbo, author of Head Wounds. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0464, and you'll find links to Dennis's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly, either in audio form for the Kindle or the old-fashioned Dead Tree version. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. When a new shopping mall opened in New York City in 2009, it was the first time people living in East Harlem had a chance to shop at retailers like Target and Costco so close to home. Building that mall wasn't easy, and because of numerous delays, it took 15 years to complete. A state official described the delays as a classic example of what is wrong with the development process in New York. Unfortunately, though, the retailers' problems didn't end with government red tape. 2 years after the opening, two teenagers tossed a shopping cart from a 70-foot-high walkway outside the mall and severely injured a woman standing below. Let's be fair, it wouldn't be surprising to hear that a lawsuit was filed, but the woman didn't sue the kids who lifted the shopping cart over the railing and threw it at her. No, she sued the mall. And recently, a jury awarded her $45 million and dealt another blow to personal responsibility in America. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
Oh, look. There he is out on the links. It's Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. I'm trying to, sink that putt, but some pesky little gopher just won't let me do it.
Well, if that isn't a hint to what you're talking about this week, nothing would be.
No, because, you know, in this edition of Book Banter, I'm going to talk about a book about a classic cult comedy. Now, comedy fans and golf enthusiasts alike will always have Harold Ramis' Way Out 1980 movie comedy Caddyshack in their collective conscience as one of the funniest movies of that genre that focused on that sport. Although there weren't that many, but still, that was one of the first. Now, yes, this is the outrageously comic misadventures of the snobs versus slobs battle amongst the fairways and putting greens at the mythical Bushwood Golf and Country Club. And that's Caddyshack. And these days, this movie is ranked as one of the greatest comedies of all time. Yet, Caddyshack's double bogey road from concept to movie immortality was basically plagued with egotistical clashes, countless bouts of unpredictability, on-set debauchery after the cameras finished rolling each day during production, a first-time director who never knew what a camera angle was, and a 400-page screen treatment in which some of its most memorable scenes were not even included, and many of them were developed while principal photography took place. And ironically speaking, Peter, you know that famous pool scene with the Baby Ruth candy bar?
Right.
That was part of the original screenplay.
With Lois Kibbe.
Yeah.
And Lois Kibbe, I was always a fan of hers because she was a mainstay in the television series The Guiding Light.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, she passed out after Carl's quote-unquote ate the duty. Yes. You know what I mean? Well, this book called Caddyshack, it's by Chris Nashawaty. He's an entertainment reporter for Entertainment Weekly. He has done more than tell the story of a cult classic movie. He traces Caddyshack's evolution, how its major players in front of and behind the cameras evolved into the world of contemporary humor that brought them to the hot and humid Fort Lauderdale set in the fall of 1979, from the Harvard Lampoon to National Lampoon to Second City, and finally Saturday Night Live. And this book is filled with an endless rich vein of behind-the-scenes stories. Most of them are quite unpredictable in nature, which makes one wonder how this movie ever got made in the first place. I mean, first there's Bill Murray. All the scenes, believe it or not, as the demented groundskeeper Carl Spackler, were filmed in the space of 6 days, because that was all the time Murray had available before he had to return to New York to do season 5 of SNL. Then there's all those drug and alcohol-soaked parties every night at the motel where the Caddyshack cast and crew stayed in Fort Lauderdale. And that's where Rodney Dangerfield was actually being the heaviest user of the pot that was being smoked there. However, this book has to have a tragic figure to it. It's Douglas Kenny, who wrote the script with Harold Ramis and Brian Doyle Murray. And he hoped that Caddyshack would be just as big a box office hit as Animal House, because he wrote the script for that one too. But thanks to his constantly erratic behavior, which was fueled by a never-ending supply of alcohol and drugs, Kenny lost control of the film to its producers. One of them was John Peters. And after the film was done, and it was about, and just after its premiere, he went on an ill-advised vacation to Hawaii with Chevy Chase, and in August of 1980, was found dead at the bottom of a cliff of an apparent suicide. Kenny's story in this book is not only a typical story of how comedians and people involved in comedy end up being sad, insecure individuals, it could easily have held up as a separate book in its own right. But I thought Chris Nashawaty's book, Caddyshack, it's a fascinating, patroning, behind-the-scenes account of how a film production that was doomed to fail from the start evolved into a true cult classic in the annals of movie comedy. Now that is a Cinderella story.
Now, I'm assuming that somebody who reads the book is going to be someone who has seen the movie. It makes no sense if they don't. Would that make sense in that saying that?
Oh, yeah. I think it would, because a lot of the stories and the scenes that were developed on set, the personalities, the actors, whoever, it's more familiar. And even though the people played had the bit parts of the caddies, you would appreciate the book more if you saw the movie first.
Absolutely.
You really would.
So the book is?
It's called Caddyshack by Chris Nashawaty. It's published by Flatiron Books, and it's $37.99.
And what other books do you recommend in a similar genre?
Well, take it on that vein of the behind-the-scenes look at cult classic comedy movies. We have two of them. One is called Fat, Drunk, and Stupid. It's the behind-the-scenes story of the making of Animal House, and it's by Maddie Simmons, who was a founder of National Lampoon, who was also one of the producers of Animal House. And it's almost in that same kind of unpredictability and debauchery that happened, in Caddyshack. It happened in Animal House, but instead it happened in Eugene, Oregon. And the other one is Hail, Hail, Euphoria by Roy Blount Jr., who's a well-known humorist. And he takes a look at the making of the Marx Brothers' classic 1933 comedy, Duck Soup, which was the fifth of their five movies that they were contracted for Paramount. And even though it's a cult classic comedy now, but when it was released in 1933, it failed at the box office, and it helped Paramount's head honchos not to renew the brothers' contract with Paramount.
Mm. Excellent choices indeed. I'm going to toss in a book, even though it's not quite in the same genre, and that it's not dealing with a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I'd bring it up because, if you remember, 2 weeks ago, we talked about summer reading. And this was something that I remembered as one of my favorite summer reads, and it ties into a movie. And that is The 007 Diaries, filming Live and Let Die. It was Roger Moore's diary of the making of his first James Bond movie. And I read it when it came out, and I love that book.
And it was a paperback originally. I have a copy of that.
Yeah, it was a paperback originally, and it has been re-released. It was re-released. Actually, it's coming out this year. It's being re-released.
Oh, really?
So for those who might want to check that out, it was called the 007 Diaries, filming Live and Let Die. So that's another one to check out.
And I bet you gave some great insights of what it's like to be to work on the James Bond film, especially that was his rookie Bond movie.
Yeah, and that was the whole idea. The book was a tie-in to the first James Bond movie, and Roger agreed to keep a day-by-day diary throughout the film's production, which was published just ahead of the premiere of the movie. And that movie came out that year in July of 1973.
Yeah, that was 45 years ago.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, still, it's still one of my favorite of the Roger Moore Bond movies.
It is my favorite, period.
Yeah, good movie.
Anyway, sir, how can people find you?
Well, you're not going to find me at the Bushwood Golf and Country Club, because that's a mythical golf and country club, or on the links. But you can find me in the pages of the Montreal Times every Saturday in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu, for being on the on the program once again.
Well, it was certainly a Cinderella story there, Peter. You know, Cinderella story.
Wrong Bond. Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you, and of course, an idiot of the day, but I've got just a little bit of time for a subtle reminder, since we were just talking about books, to talk about my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. It's still available, and like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. And that's just some of the stuff you'll find in the book. Check it out. It's available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. And you'll also find the links to the book on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So go ahead, buy the book. What are you waiting for? Okay, on June 23rd, firefighters at Engine 642 of the Henrietta, New York Fire Department went the extra mile after responding to an accident in which the injured driver was a pizza delivery man. Once the patient was cared for and loaded into the ambulance, the crew decided to finish the delivery so the pizza wouldn't go to waste. The fire department posted on its Facebook page, "If it's not delivery, it's the fire department." Yep. Another example of New York's finest. Good on you, lads. And a sense of humor, too. I like that. Elsewhere, Semen Kondorura was joined by dozens of male relatives mourning his mother's death in North Toraja, which is South Sulawesi, Indonesia, on June 15th, as they carried her coffin to a laken, a wooden stilt structure where dead bodies are stored during traditional funeral ceremonies. But as they hoisted the coffin up a bamboo ladder, the ladder broke and the coffin fell, striking people in the crowd, including Kondorura himself, who suffered a severe head injury and died on the way to the hospital. You know, there are some mothers who just won't go anywhere without their children. You'd think death would be enough to cut the apron strings. But oh no. Anyway, it's the time you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. You know what it is. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
Bhagwan Chuhan says a man and a woman had been outside her Ready Mart store in Spruce Grove, Alberta, for hours by the time they presented a credit card and tried to make a purchase. Asked to input his PIN, the man admitted it wasn't his card, but claimed it was his girlfriend's. But the real fun didn't begin until the RCMP showed up. The man threw the woman and later some snacks at a Mountie. For her part, the woman fled to a back room and found her way into the ceiling, through which she then fell. Surveillance cameras captured the goodness and the arrests. And by the way, you can watch the highly enjoyable and comic video on Facebook at the Stuff File fan page. 29-year-old Brittany Burke was charged with obstructing a cop. 28-year-old Richard Parizeau was charged with assaulting an officer and using a stolen credit card. What was he trying to buy? Soda. A $1.39 can of pop. With a stolen credit card. A can of pop. By the way, you have to watch the video to truly appreciate what morons this pair appear to be, because why, oh why, would you suspiciously hang around a store for hours, then go inside to buy a can of soda with a stolen credit card, then spend about 2 minutes throwing snacks at police and falling through the ceiling? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0464. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0464. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.